wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora, Alan.
Hi, Sarah.
How are you going this morning?
It's this afternoon even, so.
Oh my gosh. Wait, great start. Let me start again. Okay, it's afternoon by 3 minutes.
So. It is. How are you going today? It's a nice day.
It's not too bad.
We're liking this weather, so yes.
Sure.
which makes our first sort of topic a little bit strange.
Oh yeah, a little bit chilly.
Indeed, because we're going to be talking about ice.
Yes.
Ice.
Now, I tried to read the story a little bit and I couldn't understand at all really what you're talking about here. So I'd love you to explain what's happening here.
I'll give it a crack. Okay, so first question, we just sort of think of ice as being ice, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
You know, ice is frozen water and
yeah, that's I don't all think too much to about it.
Put it in your drink on a day like today and away you go.
Yeah, right.
But it so happens that there is more than one form of ice.
Mm-hmm.
More
okay.
than one form. In fact, there are now 21, or in fact, 22 different forms of ice.
What does that mean? 22. Like, how is there different types of ice?
Yeah. No.
What are some examples?
That's the question. That's exactly the question I was hoping you would ask. Okay. So there's 22 separate crystalline forms for ice. You know, the story is that the Inuit have 50 words for snow, according to Kate Bush.
Really?
Well,
did Kate Bush say that?
It's a Kate Bush album.
Oh, right. On.
Yes,
oh,
yes.
Okay. So, yeah, okay.
So, as you say, ice is just solid water. It is. So, how can you have different forms of it? Well,
yeah.
You have different forms of it in the way that the water molecules are arranged.
Okay.
So, we have this thing called, most of the ice on planet Earth is a thing called ice 1H.
Okay. Right.
Ice 1H. One meaning it's the first type of ice, okay, and H standing for hexagonal.
Okay.
So in ice 1H, all of the water molecules are arranged in little hexagons, so six-sided figures, and it all looks sort of like chicken wire, sort of. Okay, those little hexagons.
Oh, like when you zoom in really close on it. Okay.
Yeah, so, and that's the way that they're arranged. And that, if you let water do its own thing at 0 degrees and at atmospheric pressure, then it's going to crystallize in this particular form.
Right.
Okay. Now, if you go down colder, if you go between negative 53 and negative 143 degrees Celsius,
yeah.
Then, for reasons that are beyond what we're going to go into today, you get a thing called ice 1C.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of getting little hexagon arrangements of all your water molecules, now you get cubic arrangements. So they sit like little cubes.
Okay. Is this naturally occurring?
Yes. Yeah, it is. Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So in parts of the world, you can get down to below minus 53 degrees. And so at that stage, there's what we call a thing called a phase change. And ice 1H converts into ice 1C.
Oh.
Okay.
Whoa.
So all of these 22 different forms of ice that you can get are just different arrangements of the molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And those different arrangements of the molecules are the lowest energy arrangements at that particular temperature and at that particular pressure.
Yeah.
Those are the two things that you can change, okay? Now, there are some very exotic forms of ice, and so we've got ice 20, for example. That was discovered 4 years ago.
And what's that?
Ice 20, okay. So ice 20 is stable between, get this, 627 and 1527 degrees Celsius.
Like up
above?
How is that even possible?
What? Right, that is possible if you pressurize the ice to 200,000 times atmospheric pressure.
Oh.
Okay. So
I know how to do that. Yeah. That makes sense now.
So you stick it in this little diamond anvil, and then you just pressurize the bejesus out of it, and it then forms this ice form, this form of ice called ice 20. And, you know, as I say, it's stable at, you know, over 600 degrees Celsius, which is just nuts. That's totally foreign to
us. How do you like define ice then? Is it, not just it being something that's really cold, is it?
No,
exactly. How do you define that?
You define it by being a solid.
Oh.
Okay. So pretty much everything can exist in three forms. You've got solid, liquid, and gas.
Yeah. Okay.
So water can exist as solid, which is ice,
mm-hmm.
or liquid, or gas. And there's basically one form of the gas, there's one form of the liquid, and now there's 22 different forms of the solid.
Okay. What? That's crazy.
And so these folk in Korea just a couple of weeks ago have published a paper where they talk about the discovery of this new form of ice, Ice 21.
Mm-hmm.
And, excuse me, Ice 21 is not quite so extreme as Ice 20. So they used pressure around about 20,000 atmospheres, not 200,000 atmospheres, but about 20,000 times atmospheric pressure.
Yeah.
And what they did was to take this sample of water and they would pressurize it really, really quickly, and then they'd let the pressure off, and then they'd pressurize it quickly and let it off and do it again and again and again. At the same time as they were doing this, they had this X-ray laser, which is taking photos every microsecond. Every microsecond.
That's smaller than a millisecond.
It is. It's a millionth of a second.
Okay? Oh, wow. Okay.
So they're pressurizing it every millisecond sort of thing. They'll squeeze it in a millisecond, let it go in a second, then squeeze it in a millisecond.
Yeah.
And they're taking photos of this, as I say, with an X-ray laser. And basically what they found was when they did this around about room temperature or so, they would get this new solid water form, which is a new form of ice, which is Ice 21.
Okay. So this is definitely like a man-made, like you wouldn't see this naturally.
No, you wouldn't. No, because you can't get those sorts of pressures very easily naturally. So,
yeah.
So what we have here now is a form of ice that is stable at room temperature, okay, which again is totally sort of alien to what we think of as being ice. As you say, you think of ice as being cold, but it's not necessarily.
Yeah.
Okay, so there are all these different forms of ice that can exist at very specific ranges of temperatures and pressures. Those are the two things that you can change. And you can do that with any solid at all, and you can play around with pressures and temperature, and you'll find that you have different solid forms. I mean, the most famous sort of different solid forms are diamond and graphite. Those are the two basic solid forms of carbon. And again, they are the way they are because of the different arrangements of the atoms. Okay, so in diamond, it's a big three-dimensional structure, and in graphite, it's a two-dimensional structure. You have these sheets, okay, that sort of slide over each other, and that's why graphite's a really good lubricant. And diamond's really hard because it's got this big three-dimensional infinite structure that's very hard to sort of disrupt. So
yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So there you go. So that's a very quick introduction to phases and thermodynamics and first-year chemistry and stuff like that. But
yeah.
I think it is, you know, it is kind of cool. I think, you know, people always sort of throw their hands up in surprise when you tell them there's more than one different form of ice.
Yeah, that kind of blows my mind. I feel like you could really deep dive into that topic.
Oh, very, very much so. And people have, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah. We won't do that right now. We've got two more topics to talk about, and I'd love to talk about them. You've got this one about the International Space Station.
Yeah.
Your note here is, it's not going to be there forever, .. which I thought was really ominous. Can you talk about what's going on here?
No, this is cool because I heard somewhere, I read somewhere just recently, and basically since the year 2000, not all humans have been on Earth.
When you think about it, it's kind of cool.
So over the past 25 years, so on November the 2nd, so last Sunday, November the 2nd, marks 25 years of continuous human habitation of the ISS, the International Space Station.
Oh, cool.
Which again means that, you know, that since that time, not every human has
been on planet
Earth.
How many people are up there?
That's a really good question. I think
I don't even know. I can't really picture. I'm just picturing like a big... I don't know what I'm picturing in my head at all. I don't know what the space station looks like.
Well, if you know where to look, you'll see it at night. You can see it. It's just this big bright thing, and it just, you know, you can't see any sort of structure to it unless you've got sort of telescope or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's been up there, as I say, for quite some time now. And so that's a big milestone. That's 25 years, quarter of a century that it's been inhabited all the time. But as you say, it is getting old and it ain't going to be there forever.
Yeah.
And so they're making plans to quote unquote deorbit this.
Oh. Which, does it have to like land back on Earth again?
It ain't going to land. Oh. It's going to crash.
Oh, no.
We're not talking the space shuttle here. So this isn't a reusable thing.
Yeah.
So basically what they have to do is some serious calculations, lots and lots of good solid physics there. And they're going to have to try and splash it down in an area of the Earth that is uninhabited, because you wouldn't want this falling in a large city.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So they're going to have to play around and do that very, very, very carefully. And the place that they are going to put it down is a thing called Point Nemo, which I had never heard of before. But it's out way out to the east of New Zealand. So it's between New Zealand and Chile. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of the, I guess you would call it the South Pacific, but not the sort of the South Pacific that we understand as being the South Pacific. So you go over to sort of Pitcairn Island and around about there. And so this is the point that's basically furthest away from land anywhere on Earth.
Mm.
And it's about sort of 2,500 kilometres away from Pitcairn Island and stuff. So it's a big area. You think they will get it right. You'll hope that they're going to get it right.
Yeah. Don't mess up like the meters and miles
typing
again.
Exactly. Yes. Use the correct units and everything and get those thrusts right and everything like that. Now, luckily, they have got sort of previous examples of crashing down big space stations. Mm. And the two that come to mind are the Soviet space station called Mir, which was in 2001. And that went flawlessly, so that went through the atmosphere and ended up at Point Nemo. Now, there was a thing called Skylab, which was around before you were born. And this was in 1979, I think, that Skylab was brought down. And, that didn't go quite so well. So,
Okay.
So, again, it was meant to go down in Point Nemo, but it actually came down over Western Australia. So that's a wee way out. But, you know, when you're traveling at, you know, 25 or about 40,000 kilometres an hour or something like that, you know, a little goes a long way sort of thing. So
yeah, absolutely.
And so that sort of came over Western Australia, which luckily is also largely uninhabited. But I thought it was quite cute. That the Australian town of Esperance, which is on the southwest coast, they fined NASA $400 for littering.
$400? Damn, they could up that price a little bit.
I thought that was quite
cute. That's hilarious. So, of course they would do that.
So, but the biggest one that they brought back, which is Mir, that was around about 100 tons.
Mm.
Okay. So the ISS is about 460 tons.
Yeah.
And it's about 100 meters long. Okay. So this is a sizable piece of kit.
Yeah.
And being that size, it's not all going to burn up in the atmosphere. Okay, so there are going to be bits that come down, which is why they need to put it where they are planning on putting it. And hopefully this will all go well in 2030. So,
we shall see. Like 5 years away.
Yeah.
Cool.
That's so that's the plan anyway. So
interesting.
And I don't know what they're going to replace it with. I'm not sure. I haven't heard. So yeah.
Another space station?
Maybe Elon Musk will go up there.
Oh yeah.
Maybe.
I'm sure he will. Either way. Anyway, our last topic is another atmospheric one. I don't know.
It's absolutely related to that, actually. It's kind of nice that you get two sort of very, very similar stories coming out in the same week. And this is a new paper by some workers in Germany who are discussing this very thing, that we have got lots and lots of satellites up there. And, you know, when they come out of orbit, what generally happens is that they hopefully completely burn up in the atmosphere, or mostly burn up in the atmosphere, and we think nothing of it. And we think, you know, that's all fine, no harm done, it hasn't hit anybody on the ground, we're not worried about that.
Okay.
But these satellites are made of mostly metal, okay, and mostly things called transition metals, okay? And so transition metals are things like iron and nickel and copper. So, you know, sort of these elements that you would have heard of. And every time one of these comes into the atmosphere, what we are doing is actually putting iron and nickel and copper and metals like that into the atmosphere.
Right.
Because, you know, you're reaching very, very, very high temperatures. You're vaporizing, basically, these things. And so you're going to have, you know, lots and lots of metals put into the atmosphere.
Yeah, is that like a similar problem to when we had issues with the ozone layer?
Yeah, there you go, bang on.
Because, oh, right on. Yeah,
no, exactly, because nobody knew that things called chlorofluorocarbons were bad for the atmosphere. The whole point about those were that they were really, really nice and inert. They would sit around for years. They wouldn't sort of react with anything, and people thought, yep, that's great.
Yeah.
But the trouble is you put them into the upper atmosphere, and then they can interact with very, very energetic particles up there and sort of ultraviolet and beyond rays from the sun, and that actually busts them up. And once they bust up, then they start reacting with ozone and bonf. And that's why you get the hole in the ozone layer. So basically the point of these German workers who published this paper is that, look, we are putting these things to the atmosphere and we really don't know a heck of a lot about them. And what we find in labs on Earth, that these metals, these irons and nickels and coppers, they're very, very good catalysts for particular reactions. And catalysts are things that make reactions go faster.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so there's absolutely no reason why these metals couldn't be reacting with ozone up there. In fact, it's the sort of thing that they would really, really like to react with. The metal plus ozone, it's a thing called a redox reaction. You get transfer of electrons and you get very fast reactions and blah, 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 blah. So maybe this needs a lot more study. We need to be looking at this and, you know, is this going to be a problem of the order of chlorofluorocarbons in the ozone layer?
You know, so they don't quite know what the problem will be. They just kind of recognize something there?
They're talking about the possibility of there being a problem, and perhaps not enough work has been done on this, and perhaps it might be a very, very good idea to do that, given given how many, you know, I think we've got like 8,000 or something satellites up there now, you know, some ridiculous number. So
yeah,
if they're going to keep coming down through the atmosphere and putting more and more and more of these things into the upper atmosphere, it might be a good idea if we knew more about it, I think.
Yeah, so, for sure. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So, so in other words, more work is needed.
Yes.
That's, yeah.
The age old saying in the dear science. Yeah. Watch this space.
It's a mantra. Yeah.
Yeah, right on. That is all of our topics for Dear Science today. We've breezed through them. Just a shout out for MOTAT. Next Sunday, the 16th, journey into MOTAT to celebrate all things train, tram, and track with Live Day Rail. Sounds fun.
Very good.
If you're listening. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Thank you, Alan, of course, for being here in the studio today. Thank you, MOTAT. And as always, thank you, Science. That is the show today.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.